Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Nick Osello. And we are recording on Monday morning because Nick had to run the Boston Marathon. So he just finished, and congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm a big marathon guy. It was a marathon of a number of different things. And you know what? Credit to me for getting through it. I will never run a marathon in my life. And if you do and you're the type of person that makes marathon your personality, go get in a yelling match with the mirror and reevaluate your decisions.
Wow. I don't know if we want to take on marathoners on this show. I'm definitely down to do it again at some point in the future, but this is kind of their Super Bowl, so we're not going to rain on that parade. It was a marathon weekend of college lacrosse action, which is actually kind of overstating it because there wasn't a really high-profile game on Friday night. We might touch quickly on the Denver Towson game from Thursday night. Saturday was a marathon because this was the first time this season, really, that we've had a lot of thunderstorms disrupt games. So Johns Hopkins took versus Ohio State took 90 minutes longer than it was supposed to, and Syracuse Carolina managed to squeak in between the thunderclaps. But Nick, you've got it all laid out for us. Let's get it moving.
Let's just get right into it. I love it. And honestly, we'll start off. Here's how I'm thinking. We'll just start off. The Big Ten is the most interesting conference in college lacrosse right now. And they decided, the Big Ten committee had a meeting and said, you're not allowed to be 500. You're either 3-1 or you're 1-3. So we'll move down that rank, that's how we'll go through the first three games here. And we'll do it in the order of least surprising teams that you would expect to be 3-1 at the beginning of the season in the Big Ten. So Maryland moves to 3-1 and an 11-8 win over the Mamma Mia, that's a spicy meatball, Rutgers, which this ended a 16-game home streak win for Rutgers, which is a big one, and conversely continued a 17-game win streak and saw Maryland play one of their most consistent games all season. The story for them so far has been they've shown flashes of brilliance, but they've lacked consistency. This game, to me, felt consistent. While how? Seven different players scoring a goal is a good stat to show that and represent that. But even more just the game. They started out racing to a 5-goal lead, and their defense never really gave up serious runs. So between a good start, a well-balanced and contributing offense, good defense, good goaltending, good face-off. Did they put together a good game plan, or did Rutgers just come out flat and couldn't find a way to crawl back?
Yeah, it's I think a little bit more of the latter for me. And this isn't to sell short any credit due to Maryland. I do agree with you. This is probably their most consistent game of the season. But I also think that it is covered up a little bit. And John Tillman talked about this in his post-game story with Joe Santoliquito, who was on site writing it for us. But this was, to me, just it's kind of the ultimate bummer game when you get such a great home crowd and then they just get squashed early and spend the rest of the game trying to like claw their way back into it. And it takes what should have been an incredible environment for 60 minutes, and it really kind of limited it to 10 when it felt like the Scarlet Knights had a shot. I don't know. I never really felt like they had a realistic chance to win, but they definitely had an opportunity to make it close, and they did narrow the gap a little bit down the stretch. But I think that it was, you know, all of 2022 I wrote about, everybody who watched the Terrapins play knew and saw that this was a team that was so good because of how unselfish they were and how good they were at moving the ball. And there were a lot of factors that contributed to that. For me, the thing that was the most significant was Logan Wisnoskis had the profile of being their best player, but he is not a dodger. That's like his like fourth best skill. And so the way in which the entire roster kind of followed his lead was very clear. And then he was flanked by a suite of dodgers who could, you know, get to the dirt, make the defense move, and facilitate, in addition to, you know, Wisnoskis being such an effective shooter. So, you know, whether it was Keegan Kahn or Anthony DeMeo, who shall not be named, or Jonathan Donville, that was such a strength of last year's offense. And it felt like all those guys are just, they were just old, right? And so this year it was always going to be a challenge. The challenge was compounded by the loss of Eric Maliver in the fall. And when Braden Erks, I can't remember if he's a redshirt freshman or a true freshman, but was originally a class, high school class of 21. Either way, comes into the game with 11 assists on the season and assists on the first three goals of the game. That's when you see a Maryland ball movement that looked like what you saw last year, maybe in a this year's version of it. And, you know, what's interesting is the final was 11-8. They didn't win this because of their offense, but their offense is what created a circumstance whereby they were essentially able to manage it and more or less with, you know, hold on to a 5-goal lead throughout, which took a lot of pressure off their defense. And, you know, I think you saw a little bit of that as well. Brian Ruppel played really well, Ruppel, as you like to say, but you know, the six-man unit in front of him played really well as well. So, you know, it was just an all-around effort.
So it was Maryland's best performance of the year, and I kind of teed up this game as the least surprising team to be 3-1 is Maryland. But conversely, I feel like Rutgers is one of the most surprising teams to be 1-3. So with their losses coming to, I think it was Army earlier in the year, but Ohio State, Hopkins, and Maryland, this Rutgers team that's objectively good, objectively having a decent season, and the biggest surprise in the Big Ten being, in my opinion, Ohio State's victory over Rutgers. What do they need to do better to not be losing these crucial games?
Yeah, I think that it's the margin of both the Rutgers game, I'm sorry, the Ohio State game and the Hopkins game that stands out, right? Not necessarily even the fact that they lost. I think that the Hopkins game was just, you know, the Blue Jays played well. It's a good opponent. You can kind of chalk it up to maybe that's kind of the natural order of things. It really is the Ohio State game that is the outlier. And the craziest thing about it was when you look at Ohio State's struggles over the course of, you know, this last month of the year, it's been their struggles with the faceoff X. And I feel like that was an outlier performance. And they just... I don't know, this seems like a dumb thing to say, so I don't want to say it, but I can't really come up with anything better.
We're dumb guys, just say it.
It just felt like Rutgers wasn't ready for the Big Ten to start, right? Like they expected conference play to start a week later. It's kind of like you hear it this time of year all the time in the context of the NBA playoffs, where like NBA players aren't ready for the intense, some are not ready for the way in which the intensity of each individual game gets ratcheted up. And when I was watching Rutgers Ohio State, that's what it felt like to me. Ohio State was ready for conference play and Rutgers wasn't. And it's a narrow margin. We're talking about four games. We're talking about one result in the context of four games. You know, you can't be surprised to lose on the road at Homewood or at home to Maryland, who you've lost to 17 straight times. So the difference between essentially being in a position that you're okay with from a Big Ten standpoint and not is that loss in Columbus. And for me, it was just they got punched in the mouth. They weren't ready for the intensity of the game.
So we'll save what does it mean for the 1-3 teams versus what does it mean for the 3-1 teams. We'll save that until the end of the wrap-up of the next two games, but we'll make a note to say what does this mean for Rutgers. They're 1-3, but they're having a decent season. And honestly, to your point, it was sad that Maryland jumped out to a 5-0 run because in some ways, I just love this Rutgers crowd. It's that screenshot from The Sopranos, inarticulate Italian noises, and it's something that I always cherish. So, Rutgers, kind of need you to step up and not blow it in the first couple minutes next time. But that moves us to the next Big Ten game, and the second surprising or less surprising team that's 3-1, Hopkins. Hopkins putting together a pretty good year, and I remember the immediate reaction from a lot of Hopkins stands was, we're back. And they moved to 3-1 in the Big Ten with just a blowout, a 17-8 blowout of Ohio State. And this Hopkins team is fascinating because I feel like if you take away one quarter, their fourth quarter, they're a perfectly average, probably 500 team, but they always juice it up and accelerate it in the fourth quarter. Well, they decided to switch it up and put on the juice in the third quarter this time, as just in the third quarter alone, they outscored Ohio State 7-0. And that just sealed the deal. There's no coming back from that. a telling sign of this on did Ohio State play bad or did Hopkins play good? Ohio State was tinkering and shifting with defensive personnel all game, which is generally not an ideal strategy. Garrett Degnan with 4 and Russell Melendez with 3. And an interesting note about Russell Melendez, he got to that 5-5 spot and with defensive pressure threw a behind-the-back shot, which was dubbed as a Joey Spallina. So a couple different things to talk about as it relates to the Big Ten, as it relates to Hopkins. Is Hopkins good? Is Ohio State an absolute dumpster fire? Is Joey Spallina too young to have a marquee shot named after him? What's your initial takeaway?
Let me go in order. Hopkins is good. I'm not surprised that they're good. I don't think that it needs to be qualified that why and how they are good. I agree with you that part of what they have been all year is a fourth quarter team, which to me, when you do it as consistently, it's one thing when you win close games, you know, kind of Penn, we talked about it all year. That reverts to the mean. Performing better in the fourth quarter than you do in the first three quarters, that seems like something that's more of style. And as a result, I would say is like moderately more sustainable. Now, it's not perfectly sustainable, which is what we saw against Penn State, right? Like you're always, you know, if you play with narrow margins, you are going to get burned a few times. But they still played better in the fourth quarter, even though they ended up losing. In this one, I think it demonstrated growth. Now, I also think that, you know, for Ohio State losing that game against Maryland, that was kind of going to be the defining factor in can you still salvage a successful season or are you in essentially like play your best and hope mode, which is essentially what they're in now. It's hard to emotionally recover from that. You go on the road and now you're playing a team who's celebrating their homecoming, you know, 4,500 fans at Homewood. And, you know, I don't know that anything in particular changed at halftime aside from, you know, the face-off advantage, which they had all game, got more significant or more severe, and they were canning their shots, and Ohio State wasn't making saves. And at the other end of the field, Ohio State partially didn't have the ball, and when they did, they were pressing, and it just, you know, got to be one of those games where it got out of hand, and then the fourth quarter was essentially, you know, a fait accompli. And so, yeah, I came away really impressed, even more impressed by the Blue Jays than I have been all year. I think that they're pretty clearly the fifth, sixth, seventh best team. I think they and Penn State are very equivalent. For Ohio State, yeah, I mean, it does feel like a lost season. I do think that Drew Blanchard's injury, he got hurt. I'm pretty sure he played against Detroit Mercy and then didn't play subsequent to that. So that was March 15th. I mean, it's like a month ago. But basically, like, it's kind of been holding on to the rope since then. And we mentioned, you know, the Rutgers win is kind of the lone positive result in that window of time. And the thing that then, in terms of how that rolls forward, they've got a rivalry game against Michigan, but they're on the road, so that's kind of a bummer. Both teams are in a similar spot where they essentially have to win the AQ in order to get in. If they fall short in the championship game in order to stay above 500 and eligible for at-large selection, they probably will get picked. But it's really just that, like, the difference between getting to that point and now is pretty insignificant. But yeah, the loser of this game essentially gets eliminated from at-large eligibility, and it's kind of AQ or bust point. So as for Joey Spallina and whether or not it's too early for him to have a signature shot, no. I mean, it absolutely is not too early. If it is something that, like, organically arises, that you do that shot in a way that people associate it with you, you can be 5 years old, and if it's earned, it's earned. Now, you and I can make the choice, you know, individually as to whether or not we want to refer to it that way. But if the internet has deemed it so, good luck fighting the internet. I mean, you might as well take a shovel to the ocean or something. I don't know. Seems like a losing battle.
I'll take on the internet. And for any listeners out there that might be in college just trying to enjoy, can you get a patented, like, maybe just, because to make everything about myself like I always do, well, how come Joey Spallina gets a signature move but not me? So someone go out there, truck stick your defenseman, and then shoot a shot low to high 15 yards over the cage and then get pulled and get yelled at for not having the stick skills that you'd never developed because you didn't, you know, you spent more time being like, oh, I'm going to bench press a bunch instead of trying to work on your shot. Someone go out there and do that, and then I would love to dub that to Nick Ocello. And before I move on to the next game, what does someone need to do to get that signature Terry Foy move? What is the Terry Foy?
Oh, my God. I think that the pregame goalie handshake is probably this. That's the Terry Foy.
Crisp pregame handshake?
Yes.
Oh, I love it. And then moving on to the final game of the Big Ten, and I feel like this is one of the, you know, you could argue that this would be the most surprising out of Maryland and Hopkins, but Penn State is rounding out that 3-1 category after beating Michigan 11-9 due to a great and needed fourth quarter performance. This was not a, oh, Penn State beat Michigan. This was Penn State had to turn on the jets and engage scramble mode in the fourth quarter because they were down 9-6 heading into the fourth, which honestly, yeah, a testament to Michigan. Every week, you know, we see them lose, but there is so much good and so much danger coming out of this team that I feel like even though they're 1-3 and even though they're little brother Michigan, they are one of the most feared teams, not only in the Big Ten, but in college across, just because on paper it looks like a trap game, but every game they're doing something really impressive. So chalk this one up to a this team is good and scary but didn't win performance from Michigan as they just let the game slip away. And credit to Jack Traynor. He had 6 of the 11 goals and including 4 in the fourth quarter for the very first inaugural I'm him moment of the week is what I believe the kids say. That kind of felt gross coming out. But Terry, Michigan's scary, but they're now 1-3 heading into the Big Ten as Penn State survives a scare.
For sure. And obviously, in that context, the fact that that one win is over Maryland means a lot, both in terms of the way the standings are sorted, right? Because if it weren't that way, then you would basically have a 4-0 Maryland team, you know, 2-3-1 teams, 2-1-3 teams, and an 0-4 team. So the reason it is as jumbled as you're, you know, describing is because of that game in particular. And I would agree with you that I don't think that their performances and their losses, with the exception of down the stretch against Hopkins, has been that different from their performances and their wins. Maybe a little bit sloppier, but not necessarily, you know, so much worse or so much better that it suggests that what they did against Maryland, they couldn't also have done against Rutgers or Penn State, because the Rutgers loss was in overtime on the road, which is effectively a tie. So what it means relative to Ohio State, Michigan, like Michigan definitely comes in with the advantage having played better, you know, despite the fact that their records are the same in conference play. And in terms of this game, yeah, I mean, Penn State salvaged this game, right? You know, they grabbed it from the jaws of defeat. So you have to give them credit because, I mean, ultimately, it doesn't matter how well you play if you win. And they're going to be disappointed with how they played. And candidly, I think that there were probably aspects of their win over Hopkins a week ago that they were disappointed in as well. You know, but from an interest, from kind of like an interesting element standpoint. So, you know, they have Rutgers at home to end the regular season and Hopkins plays Maryland. So one of those 3-1 teams is going to win and one of them is going to lose. Depending on who it is, if Penn State beats Rutgers, they might be the number one seed in the Big Ten tournament, which, you know, I don't think that the one seed versus the two seed is like that big of a distinction or advantage because I don't think that the winner of the 4-5 matchup is going to be that much better or worse than the 3-6 matchup. It is exclusively what it means for if you get that bye into the semifinals. So just get one of the top two seeds and that's great. So, you know, if you're Penn State, it's pretty clear like we win and we get a bye. We lose and we don't. And, well, I guess I shouldn't say that because if they lose and Maryland loses, then they're both going to be tied at 3-2 and then Maryland would win the tiebreaker based on head to head. But if they win, they're a top two seed regardless. They're the one seed if Hopkins beats Maryland. So, you know, it's pretty clear what they get to play for, which is assurance that you have advanced to the last week of the season and the opportunity to avoid playing a game and get some additional rest. So, you know, the stakes are pretty clear. Penn State Rutgers is an interesting game in the context of these other two matchups in terms of, you know, where it falls on the rivalry spectrum. You know, these were teams that played each other as members of the Big East, if I know my history correctly. Yeah, I know Penn State football was an independent, but I believe you know, Penn State was a Big East member in the other sports. So, yeah, and obviously they, you know, the campuses are 3.5 hours apart and states share a very long border with each other. You know, and depending on whether you're from North or South Jersey, you have differing opinions or considerations of Pennsylvania. I don't think North Jersey people know what Pennsylvania is. I think South Jersey people tell North Jersey people that they're from Pennsylvania. So, no, that's not true. That's not true at all. This really is a Philadelphia rivalry. But yeah, it'll be a great game. And, you know, if you're Penn State, then, you're coming off this survival win, you're going back home, you feel good, but you don't feel satisfied. So, I would expect them to be in the right frame of mind in order to, you know, come out swinging, but who knows? It has been an unpredictable season, and this is an unpredictable time of year.
And then only thing before we move on from Big Ten talk, so Big Ten fans have been, fired up about the start of this episode. Everyone else has been like, when are we going to talk about anything other than the Big Ten? So the last question to you is, it's weird. Rutgers 1-3, but I would consider them, you know, playoff team, playoff material for sure, Hopkins and Penn State. So as it relates to, you know, Rutgers, Hopkins, Penn State, any others that you want to mention, how secure are their playoff spots? And is there anything that can happen that could derail or send Penn State, Hopkins, or Rutgers out of the playoffs? I'm assuming Maryland's already a given.
Yeah, and I actually think that Hopkins is as well. I mean, I did my bracketology last week, and their RPI was number 4. You know, I mean, I don't know off the top of my head the highest RPI that didn't get into the tournament, but I think it's 9 or 10. So, I was just leaving one open because I'm pretty sure it was Duke last year that was the highest rated RPI team that had not gotten.
I wanted to say something, but I also, it's a Monday morning. I'm trying not to start off a hate filled week. I'm trying not to talk about the corruption and the sickening blatant bias against underserved programs like Duke and Notre Dame. So, you know, honestly, Hopkins can sleep well knowing that the corrupt administration isn't working day and night to prevent them from achieving their dreams. So, anyways, continue.
So, yeah, I think they're pretty close to being a lock. If not, they are already a lock. Rutgers is an interesting case. Their RPI is number 11. You know, if they were to lose to Penn State, I would assume that they would fall to, you know, 12, 13. Penn State's got a great record at 8-3. Their RPI is number 8. So, suggests that, you know, the stakes of that game aren't too high. But what it does mean is that, you know, if they end up losing in the Big Ten quarterfinals, I would assume that they would be squarely on the bubble and assuredly not a lock to get in, which I would say that they are not a lock right now. So, yeah. And then, so yes, point being that, like, I think Maryland and Hopkins are locks, Penn State borderline lock, Rutgers, if they lose their next two games and finish 8-6, probably going to be bubble out. Ohio State, Michigan, as I already said, basically have to win either advance to or, depending on the outcome of this game, win the Big Ten AQ just in order to finish above 500, which would make them eligible for the NCAA tournament. And obviously, in the case in which you win the AQ, it doesn't matter. So, yeah, a lot at stake in terms of kind of postseason positioning for sure.
God, I love bracketology. So finally, moving on outside of the Big Ten, we'll go with the heavyweight tilt of the weekend, which was Duke UVA. And sneaky, one of just the biggest bully matchups of all time. 18 straight regular season wins for Duke. Virginia carrying their school notebooks and their math textbooks down the hall. Duke, wearing the varsity letter jacket, just sees them, knocks their books out of their hands, shoves them against the locker, and says, "Get out of my hallway, you nerd." And people are beginning to talk, Terry. They're saying, is Virginia ever going to beat Duke? This is bad. But Duke, for really the first 2 to 3 quarters, you could argue that they, not dominated, but certainly outperformed, and they nursed various 4 or 5 goal leads throughout the game. But the story to me was Virginia's first true showcase of resilience to come back. And maybe resilience isn't even the right word, but like over the top, storming out of the gates, this game isn't over, scrappy resilience. So going into the fourth down 12-8, and with the final score being 15-14, I think represents the story of the game. And for me, it's a nice matchup. It's fun to talk about, but it's tough to see the relevance, as we talked about last week, because really this is just for bragging and seeding rights. So Duke wins their 18th in a row.
No, I think you're right to call out the fact that Virginia came back. I picked Virginia to win this game, yeah, which felt terrible because, you know, I'm the type of guy
major?
Who... I wasn't going to call that out, but yes, exactly. Oops. I'm the guy who says I'm going to be the last one to do X, and I'm going to adhere to history as a result. But the history of this was a little confusing because when they played twice in a season, you know, Virginia is 2-5 in that second game, which isn't good, but it's also not 0-16. So that was the window where I saw, you know, maybe there's a chance. And for, as you said, you know, 45, 50 minutes, it looked like, nope, it was just another Duke-Virginia game. And then it set up one of the craziest finishes that I've seen in a long time with Brennan O'Neill taking a shot with about 30 seconds left when he could have just held onto the ball and killed the clock up one. Virginia takes the opportunity and, you know, gets a last-second shot that Will Helm saved in order to preserve the victory and prevent it from going to overtime. Just an absolutely crazy finish for a game that didn't seem like it was going to provide that level of a finish, you know, basically for, I don't know, 80% of the game.
Anything else before we just move on? I feel like that was kind of a, oh yeah, it was cool. Because I'm really excited about this next game. So
no, I think we got to mention that Connor Schellenberger missed Virginia's win over Carolina a week ago, and then played in this Duke game. So you know, this is a time of year when injuries are really hard to follow because they are so many, and the distinction between season-ending injuries, which, you know, we heard too from Princeton prior to their game against Dartmouth, and Sammy English and Luke Anderson both being done for the year. The distinction between a season-ending injury versus, you know, any type of soft tissue or ankle or you know, knee injury that you can come back from, and it's just a function of a combination of rehab and pain management, very important to monitor, you know, particularly for a player who's as important or theoretically is as important to the offense as Schellenberger is. But at the same time, you know, this Kenny Brower-Connor Schellenberger rivalry is really interesting because it goes all the way back to when they were in the club ranks, and Brower has kind of had his number. So, you know, again, just kind of something to be mindful of as you watch Virginia over the next couple weeks.
Schellenberger doesn't play against UNC, Virginia wins. Schellenberger plays versus Duke, they lose. Is Schellenberger good for Virginia? A topic to follow, and one of the dumbest things I've ever said, but I'm just so excited to talk about this next game. CUSE-UNC in the first
Why
ever...
Why are you so excited to talk about this game?
Well, I'm glad, because it's been tabbed in my notes that I wrote down here as the I told you so, na-na-na-boo-boo game of the week, where Nick correctly picked CUSE to absolutely dominate. And now Terry has to make good on his bet, which, if I remember correctly, was $1 billion. So Syracuse dominated the game, ultimately leading to a 15-14 absolute barn burner. This game was awesome. And it was a game produced by my buddy Walker, who had no prior experience. They just found my random friend down by the river and threw him into the booth. So it was hosted at Good Counsel, which... Terry, you might need some good counsel to settle this bet, so I advise that you go and get some. But honestly, I have this as the game of the weekend. A great back-and-forth heated game with the final goal being scored 12 seconds you know, before time expired. And it was one of those games where just like, even in the third quarter, but certainly in the fourth, you could just feel the intensity and the gravity of every face-off win, every shot, every ground ball, every time someone wound up. You just felt like everybody was holding their breath going, is this going to be the momentum that ends up you know, deciding the game. And I think it was represented by, you know, some UNC guy picks up the ball. The Syracuse defenseman, LSM off the wing, lays out Superman, Hail Mary checks, misses, UNC goes down and scores. And then Syracuse scores off the faceoff right after that. So ultimately it was freshman Michael Leo who scored the game winner, dodging on a pole. And I'm right, you're wrong. How big of a step forward is this for Cuse? Because their playoff dreams are still technically alive.
It's a huge step forward, but not for their NCAA tournament hopes. It is a step forward because, you know, as I've said many, many times, being good enough is not enough. Playing well is not enough. You have to learn how to win. And, you know, freshman Joey Spallina, freshman Finn Thompson, sophomore Owen Hiltz, who didn't play last year, freshman Michael Leo. It's not as if these guys are the only guys that are producing, because you've also got grad transfer Cole Kirst, grad transfer Alex Simmons, senior Griffin Cook, who scored in this game. So, and then at the defensive end, they are considerably older. But the fact is, there was a lot about the first kind of two-thirds of this game that felt familiar to the first Carolina-Syracuse game in late February, which the Tar Heels won 19-13, largely on the back of, if memory serves, a late third-quarter spurt when they got a couple stops on man down and they scored like three or four goals to separate out and then kind of cruise to victory. And for me, that was a reflection of a veteran Carolina team, or at least a comparatively veteran Carolina team, knowing how to win compared to a very, very young Syracuse team. So then, you know, the way in which their season subsequently unfolds, right? So they had three wins over teams they were expected to beat to open the season. They had four losses to teams that you would expect them to lose. Well, three that you would expect them to lose to. And then Hopkins in the Carrier Dome was just a great game. But they had an opportunity to beat Duke in overtime. And they played well enough against Maryland that you would have felt good about that. And then they play three teams that you would expect them to beat. And now they're 6-4. And then, as we've discussed, they hosted Notre Dame in the Carrier Dome. That never goes well for Syracuse. So now you're 6-5 and you're wondering, all right, we're in April. We're playing an ACC schedule. Is this the time of year when everything catches up to us, right? Whether it's injuries, whether it's residual fatigue, whatever the case may be. They go out and thoroughly outplay Princeton in New Jersey last weekend. And then they take on Carolina in a neutral site game. And what's important, I think, about distinguishing the Princeton win versus the Carolina win was the difference between learning how to hold on in the fourth quarter versus learning how to come back. And you're right to call out Michael Leo for the game-winning goal, but we'd also be remiss not to mention that Joey Spallina had two just man goals down, I guess, one and two in order to bring this game. I don't think it tied it. I think he took it from being down three to then being down one. But they were just huge, huge goals. And they were the types of moments that you look back on and say, that's the development. All that being said, you're right to call out their NCAA tournament hopes still being alive. And the simple fact is that these two wins didn't do that much for Syracuse. The Princeton win is not a top 20 win. It's not even a quality win. The Carolina win is a top 20 win, but before they beat them, it was a top 10 win. Now the Tar Heels are 13 in RPI. So the biggest difference is that Syracuse was 27 in RPI prior to the weekend, and now they're all the way up to 19. But RPI number 19 with three top 20 wins, that's essentially Army's resume, which, or, you know, it's a little better because Army Leland has one top 20 win, but that is not a resume that's going to get you an at-large bid to the NCAA tournament. If you had a win over Virginia, or if you had a win over Duke, now you're in serious consideration. And so they've done what they needed to do. They put themselves in position to make this a two-game season, and they have shown improvement. Now, is it enough to beat either Virginia or Duke? I think the smart money would say at this point, no. But
it's that type of year. It's that kind of year. And
correct.
No, that's really good analysis on the game and not great analysis on your strategy to pay me my $1 billion. So, you know, wait.
I believe that's the most expensive six-pack of Coors Light I've ever heard of. So inflation. I'm going to have to talk to my friends.
Inflation's getting crazy. Six pack of
consumer price index
dollars.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, we'll figure out a time and a place to settle this up and make sure that that video clip gets run over top of our ability to cheers as the mountains turn blue.
Mm. Cold Coors Light, cold as the Rockies. We're not sponsored by them, but we potentially should be. So moving on from the Nick is right, na 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 boo boo game of the week, which just was such a delight to talk about. Another great game, Cornell Army. So Cornell edges Army 11-10, and the weird, it wasn't a power delay or it wasn't a weather delay. It was a power outage that prevented players from seeing the game or shot clock in the last 10 minutes. So you had to go back to high school ball where one of the parents is holding an iPhone, another referee's looking at his Apple Watch going, all right, I think we're at about 10 seconds here, fellas, or at least that's what I assume. But if I had to sum up this game in one sentence, it was that both teams had to earn everything that they got. And on a broader landscape, kind of proved that Cornell is elite. They'd taken some steps back with some bad Ivy loss. And it proved that Army can hang with anyone. So I feel like this game delivered on both sides, both proving Cornell's elite and both proving that Army is a force to be reckoned with. And a team effort, as Michael Long from the Big Red and Aiden Blake were the only multiple goal scorers with 3 and 2 respectively. And for Army, it was Paul Johnson who led the way with 4. And my serious super duper intel just said that both teams would probably need an ice bath after this game.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the fact that not only could the players on the field not see the clock and the shot clock the last 10 minutes of the game, but also fans couldn't because the stream dropped out as well, is particularly disappointing. But all that being said, to your point about it being an ice bath, I mean, absolutely. One of the things that stands out to me when you just look at the box score is the way in which the number one options for each team were contained. So Reese Burke came in as Army's leading scorer and was going to guard Gavin Adler. 1 goal and 1 assist. You know, a very common strategy that opposing offenses use against Cornell is to, you know, take that guy and put him on the crease and, you know, find him opportunities based off roll-offs and that sort of thing. Not a lot of end line restarts when you're being guarded by Gavin Adler. But equivalently, I mean, I don't know who was guarding him, but what a job Army must have done defensively in order to limit CJ Kearse to 2 assists and 5 shots because, you know, he had been far and away my number one Torton favorite heading into this game, and that is his lowest point production of the year by a considerable margin. He had a 3-goal game against – or a 3-point game against Penn State and a 4-point game against against Lehigh. So, you know, he had been exceptional for the majority of the year, and he was coming off of a 6-2 game against Marquette on Tuesday. So a very impressive performance from Army in terms of their ability to take away Kearse's effectiveness. Unfortunately for the Black Knights, from an NCAA tournament selection standpoint, they needed this game a lot more than Cornell did. And they are very clearly now in AQ or bust territory, which is a tough spot for Army to be in on the basis of the way the Patriot League tournament has gone for them over the last handful of years. But at the same time, for Cornell, it is a really tough game that you don't even get a quality win for. Army falls to 21 in the RPI, and it is no longer a quality win. I voted them number 8 in my top 20 this week, and I will argue until I'm blue in the face that they are, in fact, that good because their performances demonstrate that that's how good they are where their metrics do not. And, you know, it's just a bummer. There's no other way to describe it. Army's a good team, and they're going to have to win the Patriot League in order to get into the NCAA tournament and be able to show it on the next level of the stage exactly how good they are.
I always wonder, and hey, stupid comment alert right here, but like if Army went up to Cornell, like just player to player, they were like, hey, here's our strategy. We just go up to Cornell and say, hey, guys, let's make this a close one, but we really need this. You don't really need it so much. You know, maybe take, hey, who would you rather
for
have?
For the troops.
Would you rather have us or would you rather have some other guy? Listen, we're a military academy. We're not having the most fun. We don't get to go play beer pong after this, and you guys do. How about you just do us a solid? If someone said that to me before the game, I'd be like, all right, hey, fellas, let's bring it into a huddle. we're probably going to the tournament. We're going to the tournament. Let's give them a little freebie, but let's make it close. It'd be like that episode of South Park where they play baseball and try to lose. So it's like, hey, do the Army a solid. So honestly, Cornell, maybe you should have just thrown the game. But credit to Buzik and credit to Cornell.
That's
for
the type of analysis you come to the tailgate for.
Yeah,
we should see more players throwing games.
For the troops, on behalf of our good military academies. So leave it to an Ivy League to spoil the fun. Moving on, Georgetown Marquette. And 15-14 was just the score of the weekend. I think there were three or four games. And Georgetown squeaks out a game versus a sneaky, dangerous Marquette. And if your wrong game of the week, and look at how dumb Terry is, was QCUNC. My dumb take for the season was after the Georgetown's first three games, I was like, this team's not going to make the playoffs, fire everybody. You know, you can't even fire people or release players in college, but kick everybody out, have their club team be the new Division I team, and let's get going here. Well, as soon as I thought that, they've now rattled off a 7-game win streak and have completely reversed their season, but not without drama. Because this game was a one-goal game, and they're now 3-0 in the Big East, 7-3 overall with a win over Denver. So honestly, you know, that game against Marquette, I'm generally not as interested in recapping that game as I am hearing about what is going on with Georgetown. Are they a contender? And what's your take? Because these losses now were months ago, and I'm still in this mindset of, they're no good.
Yeah, well, so I think that analyzing where Georgetown sits does start from the standpoint of trying to figure out exactly how good Marquette is, right? Because, you know, on the one hand, they have wins over Michigan and Penn State. That's really impressive. But on the other hand, they just went to Cornell on, you know, short rest and lost by 10 in a game that wasn't really competitive after beating St. John's by 10. So the point is, I think Marquette is inconsistent. So when they play well, they can beat anybody, and when they play poorly, they maybe can't lose to anybody, but they can definitely put up stinker performances. Georgetown falls under a similar category, even though on paper they've been incredibly consistent. They lost their first three games, and they've won their seven since. But the reason I think they're inconsistent is because they are inconsistent in the goal. And I don't want to assume that Kevin Warren and his staff are playing whack-a-mole, but it looks like it without having spoken to him. And the reason is because Danny Hinks, who is a grad transfer from Dartmouth, came in with a very high reputation, started the first three games, they lost. They inserted Michael Scharfenberger into the starting lineup, and he has continued to play as they've won these seven games, but he's stopping the ball at a 43% rate, and they've put Hinks into the game three times over the course of the last 2 months in those seven games. And, you know, this most recent time, Hinks played pretty well. He made four saves. He let in four goals, so stopped at 50%. But I think the consensus is that you know, folks that I spoke to that were at the game and you know, have watched this team all season told me I saw something that I hadn't seen previously in terms of the body language and the level of confidence that we saw out of Georgetown. What's interesting is that, you know, Georgetown's defensive decline year over year is the most concerning thing in terms of how much of a contender are they actually. And you can kind of point to, I think, one of the hardest things, if not the hardest thing to do in evaluating lacrosse, is separating a goalie performance from the six-man unit that plays in front of the goalie. Was Georgetown the number one or number two defense all last year because of Owen McElroy? Or were they because of the combination of, or was Owen McElroy the highest save percentage goalie because the quality of shots that a unit that included Gibson Smith, Alex Mazzone, and Zach Geddes, none of whom are on the team anymore, were giving him were so much better than the shots that these goalies are seeing now? Better as in more savable. And my point is that, like, for all of the advances in the ability to analyze lacrosse, like, that remains the thing that is the hardest to evaluate or consider. And I guess in short, like, we just don't know. But it is definitely the most important question for the Hoyas to answer. And they got to do it in short order because, you know, they have their kind of most pivotal game of the regular season now in 2 weeks as they have to take on Villanova. You know, they head to St. John's this coming – or actually, I'm sorry. They go to Loyola on Tuesday, which I'll be at, and then they go to St. John's on the weekend, and then they host Villanova to end the regular season. And there's a little bit of – the question is Georgetown going to be the number one seed in the Big East tournament, or is there going to be essentially likely a three-way tie for first with – you know, between Villanova, Denver, and Georgetown with – Villanova having beaten the Hoyas beating Denver, and Denver having beaten Villanova. Now, that does sell short the fact that Villanova has to go to Marquette this weekend. You know, tough one for the Wildcats. But at the same time, that's the story in the Big East as far as I see it right now, because you've got those three teams that in the rankings are all clustered together and are pretty much clustered together in the RPI as well. So that's going to be, you know, it's going to be what determines and what decides these teams' fates going forward.
Well, it's just weird. Like, you know, I'm in full-on bracketology. Let's look at bad losses. You look at Villanova, and it's like, you know, Yale and Brown. That's interesting, particularly the Brown one.
The Brown one. I don't want to, like, you can't throw them out. But the Brown game was unique circumstances because it was the first game that all the suspended players played. And you know, those guys felt like they were hard done by and didn't deserve as severe punishment as they received. And they played with their hair on fire. I would argue that there was nobody that Brown was going to lose to in that game.
I would argue some other ones, but point taken. So, but either way, interesting that Villanova, if we get rid of that Brown game, which I have a very difficult time doing, has put together a great season, albeit a loss to Yale, and then their loss to DU. So just going and leveraging that into Denver St. John's, they're having a similar, but as you just mentioned, not as black and white, started bad is good like Georgetown. But, you know, they did start bad. They lost to Air Force and Duke in their first, I think that was two of their first three. And then they've lost to Yale and they've lost to Georgetown, but they've taken care of business in the other games. But, you know, a 2-goal win over St. John's, who was up 7-4, you know, it just Air Force, Yale, Georgetown losses, and in the same way that we're using their more recent game as a broader discussion that you've already touched on, you know, how confident should Denver versus Nova versus Georgetown fans be?
So, you know, Denver is an interesting one. Again, we've talked about youth a lot on this podcast. And, you know, they're not young in the sense that they're not playing a ton of freshmen, but they are playing a good number of sophomores and juniors that were getting their first real game action after they replaced a lot last year. So it's not to excuse the performance against Air Force. It is absolutely the outlier in their resume. I mean, I would argue a Brennan O'Neill game-winning goal overtime loss at Duke is one of their best performances of the season for them. The loss at Yale on March 11th was one of the most important games for Yale this season from the standpoint of their ability to win left-handed, right? The Yale-Villanova game and really this weekend's Yale-Brown game, I don't take a ton from because the issue with Yale is when they get to play their game, you know, 100 shots, ton of possessions, a lot of 25-second possessions, they're so hard to play with. When it's not clicking for them or when they play a slower-paced game, that's when they've shown vulnerabilities this year. And for Yale to beat Denver when Denver controlled the game stylistically, tempo-wise, was a really impressive showing for the Bulldogs, whereas Denver's trip to Georgetown, they just got blown off the field, right? Like, I mean, just didn't play well. James Riley had it all over Alex Dathakis. He played his best game of the season. Denver couldn't get the ball, and they couldn't dictate the tempo or the game flow. And so as a result, they just play terrible, you know, and you could have looked at that from the standpoint of, you know, loss at Yale, big win over Ohio State, loss at Georgetown. the season can kind of go one way or the other from there, and it's gone one way, at least in terms of the outcomes, not necessarily in terms of the results. The performance against Villanova was awesome, but in the same way that the context of that Brown game versus Villanova mattered, the context of Denver's game versus Villanova matters too. It was Bill Tierney Day. There were, you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of alums and supporters of the program that were in attendance, and there was, you know, an event afterwards where everybody was going to be giving speeches. Like, they had to win that game, and they did. They played great. Villanova's offense looked as inept as it has all season. So then they turn around and head to Towson, which was a function of the growth of the CAA impeding upon Towson's ability to schedule that game for a weekend. So they had to play it. And it so happened that, you know, Denver was playing at St. John's this week, so they were already coming east. And Towson was hosting Hampton, which, you know, no disrespect to Hampton, but you feel more comfortable playing a midweek game leading up to Hampton than you do some of the other CAA opponents. And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, Towson prior to that game was 3-7, the Denver game. So the fact that they took the Pioneers to the mat and to the wire, I mean, that was a better showing for Towson than it was for Denver. But, you know, trip east, you survive. You're playing two games in 36 hours or 40 hours. You head up to Queens. You fall behind, but you manage to figure out a way to come back and survive. I would say that, you know, it's equivalent to Penn State in the sense that it was a game where the result mattered more than the performance. And that's, you know, you get back on the plane, you go home, you count your two wins, you get up to 7-4, and you get ready to host Providence. I think that, you know, it's just one of those things where you don't sweat too hard over how you played and how everything actually unfolded.
Well, and honestly, I feel like that's a great little wrap up to this great time of year, which is putting, at least from my perspective, putting a bigger premium and emphasis on games that have interesting playoff outcomes and scenarios. Cornell Army being, you know, kind of a premier example. I'm more interested in Cornell Army than I am Duke UVA in a top, you know, four matchup. That's crazy. But I like seeing where some of these teams have solidified. It's going to make Syracuse, Virginia much more interesting than Duke UVA was this weekend. It's fun to watch how the Big Ten's going to shape up. It's fun to watch this Georgetown, Denver, Villanova carousel all leading into conference play. This might be like the first two or three weeks where we can start talking about AP and, or not AP, but like, okay,
RPI
and ACC stealing the Ivy League's lunch and the Ivy League having a bad year. And that means it's fun for the first week, but then that dies down. Now we get to start talking bracketology stuff. So honestly, a great time of year. And Terry, your beautiful Rain Man mind, as far as bracketology, wins, upsets, RPIs, conference, AQs, it's fun to sit back and hear you have a great informed opinion while I pitch Cornell on tanking to Army just for funsies. So we really are a divided nation.
It brings up a good point, though, because the NCAA committee released its first top 10. This is something that they've been doing for, I think, like 5 years. I think 2018, 2019 was the first year they did it. And then they basically release it like, you know, one or two more times before the end of the regular season. And if memory serves, the reason that they did this the first year is because it was coming on the heels of a decision that nobody understood. Basically, like, somebody got snubbed and they didn't know why, and, you know, whatever. So it was an effort to try to, like, quell that and help folks have expectations for the way that they were thinking throughout the season. But it was so bizarre to see Army in the top 10. You know, I had them 15th in terms of the quality of the resume, and that was taking Michigan and Ohio State out because they weren't, or excuse me, Penn and Ohio State out because they weren't 500, and possibly, if they were included, having Army all the way down at 17. So seeing them at number 8, I think is where they were, was very head-scratching, but it kind of wasn't, because it was very similar to, in this ranking last year, the committee had Jacksonville at 10. And Jacksonville had three top 20 wins and a win over Duke. And ultimately what it came down to it, they weren't really in consideration for an at-large bid. I mean, we've talked about this once or twice, if memory serves. There were people grousing about who didn't get into the 2022 NCAA tournament, but people weren't shedding tears over Jacksonville getting snubbed. And it was because the way that the metrics unfolded as the last, you know, kind of month of the season went on, made it even clearer and even clearer that it wasn't going to be enough. It wasn't going to be a sufficient resume. But we knew that at the time. The way that we felt about Jacksonville when the committee released its first top 10 is exactly the same way as we feel about Army right now. So what does it mean? I don't know. I mean, it's a bizarre choice, but I guess what it means is don't overreact or assume that because Army was in the top 10 in the committee's first rankings release, that they're safe or that they're in a good position as long as they continue to win going forward. Because last year we saw them deviate from whatever their early in the process kind of point of view was. And I would expect that you're going to see it again this year because the numbers are just so clear. The Army just doesn't have an NCAA tournament resume.
Yeah, and you know, honestly, I would heed that warning to Notre Dame and Duke. Like, you know, you're not as safe as you might seem because even if you're the number one team in the country, you know, people find a way to keep you out. So, Army, Notre Dame, Duke, you know, some backdoor finagling, we'll see.
Notre Dame no longer number one in RPI. They fell to number two after Duke passed them by virtue of this win over Virginia. So. That seat's getting a little hot. I would get a little nervous if I were you, Nico.
Oh, well, you know, it is interesting. I love it all. I'm excited to just see how it all pans out. And these games that you wouldn't have had tabbed as marquee or crucially important, that's my favorite part of sports. What is going to be, and maybe this will be a good place to leave off, what's the biggest game impact playoff bracketology wise in this upcoming week? What should we be watching? We, the humble, uninformed, simple, bald fat viewer.
Well, I think like Georgetown Loyola is not a seeding implication standpoint. It is a, if Loyola beats Georgetown, is there any possible way that they can get back into the at-large consideration given that Hopkins and Maryland wins are still on their resume, despite the fact that now coming off of a loss at BU, their RPI is outside of the top 20? I think the answer is probably no, but it at least bears watching. And then equivalently, Georgetown, if they lose to Loyola, do they find themselves on the bubble? So if you don't want to wait until this weekend, that I would just advise you that that is something to watch. Ohio State, Michigan, we've already gone over in terms of just being eligible for the NCAA tournament by virtue of being 500. And then Carolina will not get in if they do not beat Notre Dame at least once over the course of the, you know, next 3 weeks. They play this week, then they have a bye, and then they play the last week of the season. So if you're a Carolina fan, I don't know for sure that once is going to be enough. It might be, but that is definitely one to keep an eye on. So, yeah, I don't think that there is one that rises significantly above all the rest, because I think that Carolina-Notre Dame game and that Syracuse-Virginia game represent something very similar in terms of, you know, if the underdog wins, then they're actually in consideration. If they lose, they're not in consideration, but they still have one more shot before the end of the season. So those two games are very similar. And then we've got game, you know, we've got a pivotal, you know, lose and you're effectively out game between Ohio State and Michigan. And then Loyola Georgetown is going to be an interesting one early in the week. So that's my summary of the games to watch from a NCAA tournament standpoint.
Love it. Middleman Terry, back at it again. We'll say that this Georgetown-Loyola game is the marquee one to watch and is going to have the biggest implication and is going to be a barn burner. It's going to come down to overtime, and that is the can't-miss game of the week from my very, very ill-informed perspective.
Nick, it's always good to talk lacrosse with you. Thank you for hosting us here on the Tailgate Podcast. If, as the listener, you like what you heard, leave a rating and review, tell a friend. And we will be back next week with more Inside Lacrosse Tailgate Podcast.
Love you.
Love you more.
Oh, stop.